content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I will read an article about the mystery writer Dashiell Hammett and then one of his short stories. So let's get started. From the Life and Letters section of the February 11th, 2002 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Tough Guy, The Mystery of Dashiell Hammett, by Claudia Roth Pierpont. At a party in Hollywood in the spring of 1935, Dashiell Hammett was asked by Gertrude Stein to solve a literary mystery. "Why is it," she began, "that in the 19th century men succeeded in writing about so many different varieties of men, and women were limited to creating heroines who were merely versions of themselves? Yet in the 20th century this situation was reversed. Nowadays," Stein pointed out, "it was the men who portrayed only themselves. And why should this be so?" Stein reasonably assumed that Hammett, a hard-drinking ex-detective whose photograph had appeared on the cover of his latest novel, The Thin Man, about a hard-drinking ex-detective, might be in a position to know. The party that evening was given in Stein's honor, and Hammett was the one person in Hollywood she'd asked to meet. Hammett had been the toast of the intellectuals, in Edmund Wilson's disgusted phrase, ever since The Maltese Falcon, published in 1930, had introduced a new type of tough guy hero in matching tough guy prose, a tight-lipped, street-smart style, determinedly flat despite flickers of amusement and startlingly devoid of most of the familiar processes of consciousness. Readers were riveted, and critics were quick to announce the newest development in the creation of an American language. It was the kind of achievement that Stein and other literary radicals had been struggling for in their brave obscurities and their unread treatises, and it had emerged from the least likely source, cheap detective stories that large number of people actually liked to read, based on the real experience of a man on a job that just happened to involve unlimited amounts of violence, sexual intrigue, and moral devastation. But the most extraordinary aspect of these stories is their long and echoing influence. In the pulps, Hammett developed not just a literary style, but the style of an era. The indelible characters that he went on to produce in his novels, Sam Spade, Nick and Nora Charles, even Asta, the schnauzer, were resilient enough to launch careers in radio, comic strips, and of course movies, where Hammett's low-down glamour and stark masculine charm have been a distinctive force from the early 30s to last year's The Score. In the long and fractured hall of American cultural mirrors, it is easy to lose track of the original image. Today, when Bob Dylan allows that his favorite film is Truffaut's Shoot the Piano Player, in which Charles Aznavour replayed Humphrey Bogart playing Hammett's idea of the ultimate urban hero, we must realize that there is still a lot, for better and worse, that we owe him. The quintessential masculine style was the work of a writer who grew up believing that being a man was a near guarantee of moral corruption. Samuel Dashiell Hammett was born in 1894 in southern Maryland, on land that could have passed for a farm if his father had not been preoccupied with drinking and women and looking for easier ways to make a living. His beloved mother, who suffered from tuberculosis, is reported to have held to the loudly voiced conviction that men were a no-good lot. Sam, her bright and curious middle child, one biographer has him reading Kant at 13, was given reasonable proof of her view when he was forced to leave school at 14 to help with his father's latest failing business. There followed several years of predictable menial jobs and predictable drinking and resentment until he joined the Pinkerton Agency, becoming a detective at 21. The job caught his imagination, and for the rest of his life, he told different versions of a story about being asked to find a stolen Ferris wheel. Hammett's best market was a crime story pulp called Black Mask, which specialized in a new kind of all-American violence. No more mischief in the vicarage, and where he was publishing regularly by 1923. This was the year his weight went down to 131 and his tuberculosis flared up dangerously, poor, sick, unemployed, drinking to forget his condition until his condition forced him to stop drinking. Hammett sat down and composed a new myth of the indomitable American male. Hammett was relentlessly compared to Ernest Hemingway, whose post-war indictment of all, quote, abstract words such as glory, honor, courage, end quote, was the first commandment of the era's literary faith. Hemingway's biographers have based credible cases for his machismo on his experience in the war, which ended with an explosion in a trench and shrapnel in both legs, and on the sexual confusion of his early childhood, when his domineering mother dressed him in his sister's clothes. Hammett's life offers neither shrapnel nor infantile cross-dressing to elucidate a controlling masculine myth that was more strictly defined and tightly defended even than Hemingway's, an ideal so stoically closed-mouthed that it eventually stranded him in silence. Spade had no original. He is a dream man, Hammett said. He is what most of the private detectives I worked with would like to have been. Hammett worked on The Maltese Falcon for nearly a year. The novel made its debut in 1929 as a serial in Black Mask, but it was, as Hammett knew, on a different order of achievement from anything he'd ever done. Of its type, just the kind of qualification that enraged Hammett, it is a perfect work, nearly classical in its austerity, its smooth meshing of parts, and the unnamed presence of so many big, old-fashioned themes, trust and guilt, and the great Jamesian theme of renunciation, which Hammett claimed to have adapted from The Wings of the Dove. Whatever its source, The Maltese Falcon does take on the same daunting task as the most resounding lyric novels of the 20s, The Sun Also Rises, The Great Gatsby, by seeking a unique language to express a unique point of view. It is the point of view of a man to whom Hammett gave his own first name, Samuel, and the physical appearance of the devil, a heavily muscled blonde Satan. Hammett was reading Spengler as well as James, and probably had Nietzsche's blonde beast in mind, with long yellow eyes and a wolfish smile. Evidence of the bruised idealism and quaking anger that suggests the moral heights from which he has fallen is confined to the slightest shifts in his physiognomy, a deepened line, a flush of red. Most of the time, however, Spade is inscrutable, and the reader is put in something of the position of a timorous heroine in a pulp romance. Small wonder that Maltese Falcon became what we would call today a crossover hit, bringing not only highbrows but women to a genre customarily known for driving both of these finicky audiences away. Over The Magnificent Spade, Dorothy Parker confided, she'd gone mooning about in a daze of love, such as I had not known for any character in literature since I encountered Sir Lancelot at the age of 9. The Maltese Falcon, published in early 1930, was found to exhibit both the absolute distinction of real art and the genuine presence of the myth. Sam Spade was a real man at last, coming after so many high-minded, effeminate detectives. One reviewer judged Hammett's writing to be better than Hemingway's, since it conceals not softness, but hardness. Hammett quickly became a star, a dazzling man about town, with his chiseled features and a crown of silver hair and his taste for fancy suits. His much-touted detective past gave him the air of being as authentically hard-boiled as his books. He was already a part of the myth himself, and he was on his way to Hollywood to write films for actors who would merely play the imperturbably cool modern hero that Hammett really seemed to be. In the 30s, Hammett wrote storylines for two Thin Man sequels and several other films, moved back and forth between New York and Beverly Wilshire Hotel, dreamed up plots for a Hearst comic strip printed under his name, and steadily drank himself out of his mind and into the Lenox Hill Hospital, where he experienced a complete breakdown in 1936. In 1938, he announced a new novel, but he soon returned the advance with a note saying that he was afraid he was petering out. That same year, MGM paid him $80,000, but turned down his draft for another Thin Man. By the fall of 1942, he was a 48-year-old alcoholic with scars in his lungs and an FBI record, but he still managed to enlist as a private in the United States Army. Lillian Hellman, who was far from being in control of Hammett's politics or of anything else, remembers the galling phone call in which he gave her the news and told her, "It was the happiest day of my life." These were to be his happiest years, too, as he recalled them, although he saw no combat and faced no test of courage. He was stationed in the Aleutian Islands, the farthest he was ever to travel, and his days consisted of tasks that were easy to fulfill and of writing letters that fulfilled his personal obligations with a similar ease. In 1945, he told Lillian Hellman that if he could stay on there, he would be able to write a new novel. But after his transfer to the base near Anchorage, with its distracting bars and brothels, he gave it up. In all the years he was so busy not writing, however, Hammett's literary legend only grew. Raymond Chandler, who published his first story in Black Mass just as Hammett was bowing out, later groused, "If a character in a detective story says, 'Yeah,' the author is automatically a Hammett imitator." Chandler paid tribute to Hammett, but vigorously distinguished himself from his example. Mystery aficionados may rattle off the easy distinctions between Hammett and Chandler: San Francisco versus L.A., Sam Spade versus Philip Marlowe, the stylistically bare versus the near Baroque. But the essential difference is that Chandler displayed the recognizable goals of a gifted novelist with a lively interest in psychology and detail, while Hammett, at his best, was unlike any recognizable sort of writer at all. Yet, for all Hammett's literary impact, it was in the movies that he made his deepest mark. No author has been better served by Hollywood. In the 30s, the breezily underhanded charm of William Powell and Myrna Loy as Nick and Nora turned a single novel into the longest-running major film series of the era. The last of the five Thin Man sequels was made in 1947. Sad-eyed, lisping Humphrey Bogart, whom The Maltese Falcon made into a star, accomplished something of the same extraordinary feat when his Sam Spade proved the original for another long, if unofficial, series that eventually drew the masculine ideals of Hemingway to Have and Have Not, and Chandler, the Big Sleep, into the persona of a single, seen-it-all, grudging romantic whose willingness to lose everything but his honor was just what the country needed while getting through the war. Reluctantly returning to the outer world in 1945, Hammett continued to earn fame and reasonable fortune through frequent radio adaptations of his books, which were based on scripts that he refused to write or read or even to discuss. Living quietly, he divided his time between Marxist-style politics and Bowery-style drinking in New York and on Lillian Hellman's Westchester farm. Beginning in 1946, he lectured on crime fiction and the possibility of the detective story as a progressive medium in literature at a Marxist school in Lower Manhattan. But the revolutionary possibilities of the genre became apparent sooner than expected when, that same year, Albert Camus arrived in New York for the American publication of The Stranger, the murder novel whose existential sang-froid was inspired, as the author later revealed, by the great American detective stories and their fast-talking American prose. Camus, dark and handsome in his trench coat, told people how pleased he was whenever his resemblance to Humphrey Bogart was pointed out. In late 1960, Hammett was diagnosed with lung cancer, and he died just a few months later in January 1961. Silence was always at the edge of Hammett's style, The white space on many of his pages nearly equals the quantity of print, the short lines of dialogue snapping off as soon as the necessary thing is said, if not before. He made inarticulateness into a style and a heroic mode of being. Few American writers, not even Gertrude Stein, came so close to the radical purity of words stripped down to their far from routine nakedness. It was a treacherous ideal, part nobility and part pathology, and as a writer it brought him to the very end of words. Yet, in a few short years, Hammett turned out a few short books that have yielded a chorus of voices and a phantasmagoria of beloved images. Sidney Greenstreet frantically hacking at a lead bird with a penknife. William Powell lying on his back and tipsily shooting lights out with a pop gun. Bogart grabbing Mary Astor for one short, hard kiss. Before the gift just went, like a fist when you open your hand. Now I will read one of three Hammett short stories with Sam Spade as a major character. Too Many Have Lived, first published in 1932 in American Magazine. A man's tie was as orange as a sunset. He was a large man, tall and meaty without softness. The dark hair parted in the middle, flattened to his scalp, his firm, full cheeks. The clothes that fit him with noticeable snugness. Even the small pink ears flat against the sides of his head. Each of these seemed but a differently colored part of one same smooth surface. His age could have been 35 or 45. He sat beside Samuel Spade's desk, leaning forward a little over his malacca stick and said, "No, I want you to find out what happened to him. I hope you never find him." His protuberant green eyes stared solemnly at Spade. Spade rocked back in his chair, his face given a not unpleasantly satanic cast by the V's of his bony chin, mouth, nostrils, and thickish brows was as politely interested as his voice. "Why?" The green-eyed man spoke quietly with assurance. "I can talk to you, Spade. You've the sort of reputation I want in a private detective, and that's why I'm here." Spade's nod committed him to nothing. The green-eyed man said, "And any fair price is all right with me." Spade nodded as before. "And with me," he said, "but I've got to know what you want to buy. If you want to find out what's happened to this Eli Haven, but you don't care what it is?" The green-eyed man lowered his voice, but there was no other change in his mien. "In a way I do. For instance, if you found him and fixed it so he stayed away for good, it might be worth more money to me."
"You mean even if he didn't want to stay away?"
The green-eyed man said, "Well, especially." Spade smiled and shook his head. "Probably not enough more money in the way you mean it." He took his long, thick-fingered hands from the arms of his chairs and turned their palms up. "Well, what's it all about, Collier?" Collier's face reddened a little, but his eyes maintained their unblinking, cold stare. "The man's got a wife. I like her. They had a row last week, and he blew. If I can convince her he's gone for good, there's a chance she'll divorce him."
"Well, I'd want to talk to her," Spade said. "Who is this Eli Haven? What does he do?"
"Oh, he's a bad egg. He doesn't do anything. He writes poetry or something."
"Well, what can you tell me about him that'll help?"
"Nothing Julia, his wife, can't tell you. You're going to talk to her." Collier stood up. "I've got connections. Maybe I can get something for you later on." A small boned woman of 25 or 6 opened the apartment door. Her powder blue dress was trimmed with silver buttons, and she was full bosomed, but slim, with straight shoulders and narrow hips. And she carried herself with a pride that would have been cockiness in one less graceful. Spade said, "Miss Haven?" She hesitated before saying, "Yes." "Gene Collier sent me to see you.
My name's Spade. I'm a private detective, and he wants me to find your husband.
Well, have you found him?
I told him I'd have to talk to you first. Her smile went away. She studied his face gravely, feature by feature. And then she said, certainly, and stepped back, drawing the door back with her. When they were seated and facing chairs in a cheaply furnished room, overlooking a playground where children are noisy, she asked, did Gene tell you why he wanted Eli found? He said, if you knew he was gone for good, maybe you'd listen to reason. And she said nothing. Has he ever gone off like this before?
Often.
Well, what's he like? He's a swell man, she said dispassionately, when he's sober. And when he's drinking, he's all right except with women and money.
Well, that leaves him a lot of room to be all right in. What does he do for a living?
He's a poet, she replied. But nobody makes a living at that.
Well?
Oh, he pops in with a little money now and then. Poker, races, he says.
I don't know.
Well, how long have you been married?
4 years, almost.
He smiled mockingly. San Francisco all the time?
No, we lived in Seattle the first year and then came here.
He from Seattle?
She shook her head. Some place in Delaware.
Well, what place?
I don't know.
Spade drew his thickest brows together a little and said, well, where are you from? And she said sweetly,
you're not hunting for me.
You act like it, he grumbled. Well, who are his friends?
Don't ask me.
He made an impatient grimace. Well, you know some of them, he insisted.
Sure, there's a fellow named Manera and a Louis James and somebody he calls Connie.
Well, who are they?
Men, she replied blandly. I don't know anything about them. They phone or drop by to pick him up, or I see him around town with them, but that's all I know.
Well, what do they do for a living? They can't all write poetry.
She laughed. Oh, they could try. One of them, Louis James, is a member of Gene's staff, I think. You know, I honestly don't know any more about them than I've told you.
Think they'd know where your husband is?
She shrugged. They're kidding me if they do. They still call up once in a while to see if he's turned up.
And these women you mentioned?
Well, they're not people I know.
Spade scowled thoughtfully at the floor and asked, what'd he do before he started not making a living writing poetry?
Oh, anything. He sold vacuum cleaners, hoboed, went to sea, dealt blackjack, railroaded, canning houses, lumber camps, carnivals, worked on a newspaper. Anything.
Have any money when he left?
$3 he borrowed from me.
What'd he say?
She laughed. Said if I used whatever influence I had with God while he was gone, he'd be back at dinner time with a surprise for me.
Spade raised his eyebrows. You were on good terms?
Oh, yes. Our last fight had been patched up a couple of days before.
Well, when did he leave?
Thursday afternoon, 3 o'clock, I guess.
Got any photographs of him?
Yes.
She went to a table by one of the windows, pulled a drawer out, and turned towards Spade again with a photograph in her hand. Spade looked at the picture of a thin face with deep-set eyes, a sensual mouth, and a heavily lined forehead topped by a disorderly mop of coarse blonde hair. He put Haven's photograph in his pocket and picked up his hat. He turned towards the door, halted.
What kind of poet is he?
Pretty good?
She shrugged. Well, that depends on who you ask.
Any of it around here?
No, she smiled. You think he's hiding between pages?
You never can tell what'll lead to what. I'll be back sometime. Think things over and see if you can't find some way of loosening up a little more. Bye. He walked down Post Street to Mulford's bookstore and asked for a volume of Haven's poetry.
I'm sorry, the girl said. I sold my last copy last week. And she smiled. To Mr. Haven himself. I can order it for you. You know him?
Well, only through selling him books. Spade pursed his lips and asked, what day was it?
He gave her one of his business cards. Please, it's important. She went to a desk, turned the pages of a red-bound sales book, and came back to him with the book open in her hand. It was last Wednesday, she said, and we delivered it to a Mr. Roger Ferris, 1981 Pacific Avenue.
Huh, thanks a lot, he said.
Outside, he hailed a taxi cab and gave the driver Mr. Roger Ferris's address. The Pacific Avenue house was a four-story gray stone set behind a narrow strip of lawn. The room into which a plump-faced maid ushered Spade was large and high-ceilinged. Spade sat down. But when the maid had gone away, he rose and began to walk around the room. He halted at a table where there were three books. One of them had a salmon-colored jacket, on which was printed in red an outline drawing of a bolt of lightning striking the ground between a man and a woman, and in black, the words, Colored Light by Eli Haven. Spade picked up the book and went back to his chair. There was an inscription on the flyleaf, heavy, irregular characters written with blue ink. To good old Buck, who knew his colored lights, in memory of them there days, Eli. Spade turned pages at random and idly read a verse, statement. Too many have lived as we live, for our lives to be proof of our living. Too many have died as we die, for their deaths to be proof of our dying. He looked up from the book as a man in dinner clothes came into the room. He was not a tall man, but his erectness made him seem tall, even when Spade 6 feet and a fraction of an inch were standing before him. He had bright blue eyes, undimmed by his 50-some years, a sunburned face in which no muscle sagged, a smooth, broad forehead, and thick, short, nearly white hair. There was dignity in his countenance and amiability. He nodded at the book Spade still had. How do you like it? Spade grinned and said, I guess I'm just a mug, and put the book down. But that's what I came to see you about, though, Mr. Ferris. You know Haven?
Yes, certainly. Sit down, Mr. Spade.
He sat in a chair not far from Spade's.
I knew him as a kid.
He's not in trouble, is he?
Spade said, I don't know. I'm trying to find him.
Ferris spoke hesitantly. Can I ask why?
You know Gene Collier?
Yes. Ferris hesitated again and then said, this is in confidence. I have a chain of picture houses through Northern California, you know, and a couple of years ago, when I was having some labor trouble, I was told that Collier was the man to get in touch with to have it straightened out. That's how I happened to meet him.
Yes, Spade said dryly. A lot of people happen to meet Gene that way.
But what's he got to do with Eli?
Wants him found. How long since you've seen him?
Last Thursday he was here.
What time did he leave?
Midnight, a little after. Came over in the afternoon around 3:30. We hadn't seen each other for years, and I persuaded him to stay for dinner, and he looked pretty seedy, so I lent him some money.
How much?
150, all I had in the house.
Say where he was going when he left?
Ferris shook his head. He said he'd phone me the next day.
Did he phone you the next day?
Nah.
And you've known him all his life?
Well, not exactly. But he worked for me 15, 16 years ago when I had a carnival company. Great Eastern and Western combined shows. With a partner for a while and then by myself. And I always liked that kid.
How long before Thursday since you'd seen him?
Lord knows, Ferris replied. I'd lost track of him for years. And then Wednesday, out of a clear sky, that book came. with no address or anything, just that stuff written in the front, and the next morning he called me up. I was tickled to death to know he was still alive and doing something with himself. So he came over that afternoon, and we put in about 9 hours straight talking about old times. Tell you much about what he'd been doing since then? Just that he'd been knocking around, doing one thing and another, taking the breaks as they came. He didn't complain much. I had to make him take the 150. Spade stood up. Thanks ever so much, Mr. Ferris. Ferris interrupted him. Not at all. And if there's anything I can do, call on me. Spade looked at his watch. Can I phone my office to see if anything's turned up? Certainly. There's a phone in the next room to the right. Spade said thanks and went out. When he returned, he was rolling a cigarette and his face was wooden. Any news? Ferris asked. Yes. Collier's called the job off. He says Haven's body's been found in some bushes on the other side of San Jose with 3 bullets in it. He smiled, adding mildly, he told me he might be able to find out something through his connections. Morning sunshine, coming through the curtains that screened Spade's office windows, put 2 fat yellow rectangles on the floor and gave everything in the room a yellow tint. He sat at his desk, staring meditatively at a newspaper. He did not look up when Effie Perrine came in from the outer office, and she said, Mrs. Haven is here. He raised his head then and said, well, that's better. Push her in. Mrs. Haven came in quickly. Her face was white, and she was shivering in spite of her fur coat and the warmth of the day. She came straight to Spade and asked, did Gene kill him? Spade said, I don't know. I've got to know, she cried. Spade took her hands. Here, sit down. He led her to a chair. He asked, Collier tell you he'd called the job off? She stared at him in amazement. He what? He left word here last night that your husband had been found and he wouldn't need me anymore. She hung her head and her words were barely audible. And he did. Spade shrugged. Maybe only an innocent man could have afforded to call it off then, or maybe he was guilty. But he had brains enough and nerve enough to. She was not listening to him. She was leaning towards him, speaking earnestly. But Mr. Spade, you're not going to drop it like that? You're not going to let him stop you? While she was speaking, his telephone bell rang. He said, excuse me. And he picked up the receiver. Yes, So, he pursed his lips. Okay, I'll let you know. He pushed the telephone aside slowly and faced Mrs. Haven again. Collier's outside. Does he know I'm here? She asked quickly. Couldn't say. He stood up, pretending he was not watching her closely. You care? She pinched her lower lip between her teeth and said, no, hesitantly. Fine, I'll have him in. She raised a hand as if in protest and then let it drop, and her white face was composed. Oh, whatever you want, she said. Spade opened the door, said, hello, Collier. Come on in. We were just talking about you. Collier nodded and came into the office holding his stick in one hand, his hat in the other. How are you this morning, Julia? You ought to have phoned me. I'd have driven you back to town. I didn't know what I was doing. Collier looked at her for a moment longer and then shifted the focus of his expressionless green eyes to Spade's face. Well, have you been able to convince her I didn't do it? We didn't get around to that, Spade said. I was just trying to find out how much reason there was for suspecting you. Sit down. Collier sat down somewhat carefully and asked, and then you arrived. Collier nodded gravely. All right, Spade, he said. You're hired again to prove to Mrs. Haven that I didn't have anything to do with it. Gee, she exclaimed in a choked voice and held her hands out toward him appealingly. I don't think you do it. I didn't want you to think you did, but I'm so afraid. She put her hands to her face and began to cry.
Toyer went over to the woman. Take it easy, he said. We'll pick it out together. Spade went into the outer office, shutting the door behind him. Effie Perrine stopped typing a letter. He grinned at her and said, somebody ought to write a book about people sometime. They're peculiar. And he went over to the water bottle. You got Willie Kellogg's number? Call him up. Ask him where I can find Tom Minera. He returned to the inner office. Mrs. Haven had stopped crying, and she said, I'm sorry. And Spade said, it's all right. He looked sideways at Collier. I still got my job? Yes, Collier cleared his throat. But if there's nothing special right now, I'd better take Mrs. Haven home. Okay. But there is one thing. According to the Chronicle, you identified him. How come you were down there? I went down there when I heard they'd found a body, Collier replied deliberately. I told you I had connections. I heard about the body through them. Spade said, all right, I'll be seeing you. And Spade opened the door for them. And when the corridor door closed behind them, Effie Perrine said, Minera's at the Buxton on Army Street. Spade said, thanks. He went into the inner office to get his hat. On his way out, he said, if I'm not back in a couple of months, tell them to look for my body there. Spade walked down a shabby corridor to a battered green door marked 411. The murmur of voices came through the door, but no words could be distinguished. He stopped listening and knocked. An obviously disguised male voice asked, what is it? I want to see Tom. This is Sam Spade. A pause then. Tom ain't here. Spade put a hand on the knob and shook the frail door. Come on, open up, he growled. Presently, the door was opened by a thin, dark man of 25 or 26 who tried to make his beady dark eyes guileless while saying, I didn't think it was your voice at first. The slackness of his mouth made his chin seem even smaller than it was. His green striped shirt, open at the neck, was not clean, and his gray pants were carefully pressed. You got to be careful these days, Spade said solemnly, and went through the doorway into a room where two men were trying to seem uninterested in his arrival. One of them leaned against the windowsill, filing his fingernails. The other was tilted back in a chair with his feet on the edge of a table and a newspaper spread between his hands. They glanced at Spade in unison and went on with their occupations. Spade said cheerfully, always glad to meet any friends of Tom Minera's. Minera finished shutting the door and said awkwardly, yes, Mr. Spade, meet Mr. Conrad and Mr. James. Conrad, the man at the window, made a vaguely polite gesture with the nail file on his hand. He was a few years older than Minera and of average height, sturdily built, with a thick-featured, dull-eyed face. James lowered his paper for an instant to look coolly, appraisingly at Spade and say, how are you, brother? Then he returned to his reading. He was as sturdily built as Conrad, but taller, and his face had a shrewdness the others lacked. Ah, Spade said, and friends of the late Eli Haven. The man at the window jabbed a finger with his nail file and cursed it bitterly. Minera moistened his lips and then spoke rapidly, with a whining note in his voice. But on the level, Spade, we ain't. None of us had seen him for a week. Spade seemed mildly amused by the dark man's manner. What do you think he was killed for?
All I know is what the paper says. His pockets was all turned inside out, and there wasn't as much as a match on him.
He drew down the ends of his mouth.
But far as I know, he didn't have no dough. He didn't have none Tuesday night.
Spade, speaking softly, said, I hear he got some Thursday night. Minera, behind Spade, caught his breath audibly. James said, I guess you ought to know.
I don't. You ever work with you boys?
James slowly put aside his newspaper and took his feet off the table. His interest in Spade's questions seemed great enough, but almost impersonal.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Spade pretended surprise.
Huh. But you boys must work at something.
Manera came around to Spade's side. Ah, listen, Spade, he said. This guy Haven was just a guy we knew. We didn't have nothing to do with rubbing him out.
We don't know nothing about it. You know, we...
Three deliberate knocks sounded at the door. Manera and Conrad looked at James, who nodded. But by then Spade, moving swiftly, had reached the door and was opening it. Roger Ferris was there. Spade blinked at Ferris. Ferris at Spade. And then Ferris put out his hand and said, I am glad to see you. Come on in, Spade said. Look at this, Mr. Spade. Ferris' hands trembled as he took a slightly soiled envelope from his pocket. Ferris' name and address were typewritten on the envelope. There was no postage stamp on it. Spade took out the enclosure, a narrow slip of cheap white paper, and unfolded it. On it was typewritten. You had better come to room number 411, Buxton Hotel on Army Street at 5 p.m. this afternoon on account of Thursday night. There was no signature. And Spade said, it's a long time before 5 o'clock. It is, Ferris agreed with emphasis. I came as soon as I got that. It was Thursday night. Eli was at my house. Manera was jostling Spade, asking, what's all this? Spade held the note up for the dark man to read, and he read it and yelled, honest, Spade, I don't know nothing about that letter. Does anybody? Spade asked. Conrad said, no, hastily. James said, what letter? Spade looked dreamily at Ferris for a moment and then said, as if speaking to himself, of course, Haven was trying to shake you down. Ferris's face reddened. What? Shakedown, Spade repeated patiently. Money. Blackmail. Look here, Spade, Ferris said earnestly. You don't really believe what you said.
What would he have to blackmail me on?
To good old Buck, Spade quoted the dead poet's inscription, who knew his colored lights in memory of them there days. He looked somberly at Ferris from beneath slightly raised brows. What colored lights? What's the circus and carnival slang term for kicking a guy off a train while it's going? Red lighting. Sure, that's it, red lights. Who'd you red light, Ferris, that Haven knew about? Manera went over to a chair, sat down, and put his elbows on his knees, his head between his hands, and stared blankly at the door. Conrad was breathing as if he'd been running. Spade addressed Ferris. Well, Ferris wiped his face with a handkerchief, put the handkerchief in his pocket, and said simply, it was a shakedown, and you killed him. Ferris's blue eyes, looking into Spade's yellow-gray ones, were clear and steady, as was his voice. I did not, he said. I swear I did not. Let me tell you what happened. He sent me the book, as I told you, and I knew right away what that joke he wrote in the front meant. So, the next day, when he phoned me and said he was coming over to talk over old times and try to borrow some money for old times' sake, I knew what he meant again, and I went down to the bank and drew out $10,000. You can check that up. It's the Seaman's National. I will, Spade said. As it turned out, I didn't need that much. He wasn't very big time, and I talked him into taking $5,000. I put the other $5,000 back in the bank next day, and you can check that up, too. I will. I told him I wasn't going to stand for any more taps. This $5,000 was the first and the last. I made him sign a paper saying he'd helped in the, well, what I'd done, and he signed it. He left sometime around midnight, and that's the last I ever saw of him. Spade tapped the envelope Ferris had given him.
And how about this note? A messenger boy brought it at noon, and I came right over. Eli had assured me he hadn't said anything to anybody, but I didn't know. I had to face it, whatever it was. Spade turned to the others, his face wooden. Well? Minera and Conrad looked at James, who made an impatient grimace and said, Oh, sure, we sent him the letter. Why not? We was friends of Eli's, and we hadn't been able to find him since he went to put the squeeze to this baby. And then he turns up dead. So we kind of like to have the gent come over and explain things. You knew about the squeeze? Sure, we was all together when he got the idea. How'd he happen to get the idea? Spade asked. James spread the fingers of his left hand. We'd been drinking and talking and, you know, the way a bunch of guys will about all they'd seen and done. And he told a yarn about once seeing a guy boot another one off a train into a canyon. And he happens to mention the name of the guy who done the booting, Buck Ferris. And somebody says, what's this Ferris look like? And Eli tells him what he looked like then and saying he ain't seen him for 15 years. And whoever it is whistles and says, whew, I bet that's the Ferris that owns about half the movie joints in the state. I bet you he'd give something to keep that back trail covered. Well, the idea kind of hit Eli. You could see that. He thought a little while and then he got cagey. He asks what this movie's Ferris's first name is. When the other guy tells him Roger, he makes out he's disappointed and says, nah, it ain't him. His first name was Martin. And we all give him the ha-ha, and he finally admits he's thinking of seeing the gent. And when he called me up Thursday around noon and says he's throwing a party at Pogie Hecker's that night, it ain't no trouble to figure out what's what. What was the name of the gentleman who was red-lighted? He wouldn't say. He shut up tight. You couldn't blame him. Uh-huh. Spade agreed. Then nothing. He never showed up at Pogie's. We tried to get him on the phone around 2 o'clock in the morning, but his wife said he hadn't been home. So we stuck around till 4 or 5, then decided he had given us a runaround and made Pogie charge the bill to him, and we beat it. I ain't seen him since. Dead or alive. Spade said mildly, maybe. Sure you didn't find Eli later that morning? Take him riding? Swap him bullets for Ferris's 5 thou? Dumping in the... A sharp double knock sounded on the door. Spade's face brightened. He went to the door and opened it. A young man came in. He was very dapper and very well proportioned. He wore a light top coat, and his hands were in his pockets. Just inside the door, he stepped to the right and stood with his back to the wall. By that time, another young man was coming in, and he stepped to the left. Though they did not actually look alike, their common dapperness, their similar trimness of their bodies, and their almost identical positions, backs to wall, hands in pockets, cold. Bright eyes studying the occupants of the room, gave them, for an instant, the appearance of twins. And then Gene Coyer came in. He nodded at Spade, but made no attention to the others in the room, though James said, Hello, Gene. Anything new? Coyer asked Spade. Spade nodded. It seems this gentleman, and he jerked a thumb at Ferris, was... Any place we can talk? There's a kitchen back here. Coyer snapped a, smear anybody that pops, over his shoulder at the two dapper young men and followed Spade into the kitchen. He sat on the one kitchen chair and stared with unblinking green eyes at Spade while Spade told him what he had learned. When the private detective had finished, the green eye man asked, Well, what do you make of it? Spade looked thoughtfully at the other. You picked up something, and I'd like to know what it is. Coyer said, They found the gun in a stream a quarter of a mile from where they found him. It's James's. Got the mark on it where he was shot out of his hand once in Vallejo. That's nice. Spade said. Listen, a kid named Thurber says James comes to him last Wednesday and gets him to Tailhaven. Thurber picks him up Thursday afternoon, puts him in at Ferris's, and phones James. James tells him to take a plant on the place and let him know where Haven goes when he leaves, but some nervous woman in the neighborhood puts in a rumble about the kid hanging around, and the cops chase him along about 10 o'clock. Spade pursed his lips and stared thoughtfully at the ceiling. Collier's eyes were expressionless, but sweat made his round face shiny, and his voice was hoarse. Spade, he said, I'm going to turn him in. Spade switched his gaze from the ceiling to the protuberant green eyes. I've never turned in one of my people before, Collier said, but this one goes. Julia's got to believe I had anything to do with it. If it's one of my people and I turn him in, hasn't she? Spade nodded slowly. I think so. Collier suddenly averted his eyes and cleared his throat. When he spoke again, it was curtly. Well, he goes. Minera, James, and Conrad were seated when Spade and Collier came out of the kitchen. Ferris was walking the floor. The two dapper young men had not moved. Collier went over to James. Where's your gun, Lewis? He asked. James moved his right hand a few inches toward his left breast, stopped it, and said, Oh, I didn't bring it. With his gloved hand open, Collier struck James on the side of the face, knocking him out of his chair. James straightened up, mumbling, I didn't mean nothing. And he put a hand to the side of his face. I know I oughtn't have done it, but Chief, but when he called up and said he didn't like to go up against Ferris without something and didn't have any of his own, I said, all right, and sent it over to him. Collier said, and you sent Thurber over to him too. We were just kind of interested in seeing if he did go through with it. James mumbled, and you could have gone there yourself or sent somebody else, huh? After Thurber had stirred up the whole neighborhood? Collier turned to Spade. Want us to help you take them in or want to call the wagon? We'll do it regular, Spade said, and went to the wall telephone. When he turned away from it, his face was wooden, his eyes dreamy. He made a cigarette, lit it, said to Collier, I'm silly enough to think your Lewis has got a lot of right answers in that story of his. James took his hand down from his bruised cheek and stared at Spade with astonished eyes. Collier growled, What's the matter with you? Nothing, Spade said softly. Except I think you're a little too anxious to slam it on it. He blew smoke out. Why, for instance, should he drop his gun there when it had marks on it that people knew? Collier said, You think he's got brains? If these boys killed him, knew he was dead, why do they wait till the body's found and things are stirred up before they go after Ferris again? What'd they turn his pockets inside out for if they hijacked him? That's a lot of trouble, and only done by folks that kill for some other reason and want to make it look like robbery. He shook at his. You're too anxious to slam it on them. Why should they? That's not the point right now, Collier said. The point is, why do you keep saying I'm too anxious to slam it on him? Spade shrugged. Maybe to clear yourself with Julia as soon as possible and as clear as possible. Maybe even to clear yourself with the police and then you've got clients. What? Collier said. Spade made a careless gesture with his cigarette. Ferris, he said blandly. He killed him, of course. Collier's eyelids quivered, though he did not actually blink. And Spade said, First, he's the last person we know of who saw Eli alive, and that's always a good bet. Second, he's the only person I talked to before Eli's body turned up who cared whether I thought they were holding out on me or not. The rest of you thought I was hunting for a guy who'd gone away. He knew I was hunting for a man he'd killed, so he had to put himself in the clear. He was even afraid to throw that book away because it had been sent up by the bookstore and could be traced. And there might be clerks who'd seen the inscription. Third, he was the only one who thought Eli was just a sweet, clean, lovable boy, for the same reason. Fourth, that story about a blackmailer showing up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, making an easy touch for $5,000 and then sticking around till midnight is just silly, no matter how good the booze was. Fifth, the story about the paper Eli signed is still worse, though a forged one could be fixed up easy enough. Sixth, he's got the best reason for anybody we know for wanting Eli dead. Collier nodded slowly. Still nothing, Spade said. Maybe he did the 10,000 out of 5,000 back trick with his bank, but that was easy. Then he got this feeble-minded blackmailer in his house, stalled him along until the servants had gone to bed, took the borrowed gun away from him, shoved him downstairs into his car, took him for a ride, maybe took him already dead, maybe shot him down there by the bushes. Frisk him clean to make identification harder and to make it look like robbery. Tossed the gun in the water, came home. He broke off to listen to the sound of a siren in the street. He looked then, for the first time since he had begun to talk, at Ferris. Ferris's face was ghastly white, but he held his eyes steady. Spade said, "I got a hunch, Ferris, that we're going to find out about that red lighting job, too. You told me you had a carnival company with a partner for a while when Eli was working for you, and then by yourself. We oughtn't to have a lot of trouble finding out about your partner, whether he disappeared or died a natural death or still alive." Ferris had lost some of his erectness. He went wet his lips and said, "I want to see my lawyer. I don't want to talk till I see my lawyer." Spade said, "It's all right with me. You're up against it. But I don't like blackmailers myself. I think Eli wrote a good epigraph for them in that book back there. Too many have lived."
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New York readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. I'm Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.